or white, ruling class. She had expected to find all Luaran in service and all the brown or Raka folk as slaves. She had also expected that, as a Luaran and a slave, she would need to prove over and over her ability to find tender spots on a Raka tormentor's body before he or she decided to leave her alone. Instead, the pure Raka cook, Chenaul, had taken Ali under her wing and introduced her to a household that contained a majority of part and full Raka servants and slaves, in addition to pure Luaran slaves like Ali, purchased as they came into the Isle's markets. As head cook, the wickedly humorous Raka woman ran the kitchens with a firm brown hand and a sharp brown eye, supervising Luaran, part Raka, and full Raka servants and slaves. She made it clear to all who came through her door that Ali was to be left alone. "They gave her away, poor lass," Chenaul had told the household. "She's got enough on her plate without you lot tormenting her." It seemed Chenaul's word was law, regardless of her ancestry. Ali admired the woman. Chenaul was in her mid-50s, a tart-tongued woman with sharp eyes. There were a few gray streaks in the coarse black hair she wore in a braid down her plump back. Her skin was the coppery brown shade of a full-blood Raka, creased with light wrinkles about the eyes and mouth. Busy as she was, she still found time to show Ali the ropes in the rambling mansion. The strangeness of this household didn't end with Chenaul. Ulasim, the brawny head footman, was also a full-blood Raka. Of the Balitang's chief servants, the housekeeper, the steward, the coachman, and the healer were pure Luaran and free, as was Veron, the commander of the men-at-arms. The chief hostler, the elderly Lokage, was a full-blood Raka slave who didn't seem to notice the collar around his neck, and half the hostlers who served under his eye were free and of mixed parentage. If the Raka of the Isles were oppressed by their Luaran masters, it was a thin, watery oppression in the Balitang household. Already, Ali had learned that the Duke, the master of this house, had taken one of the Raka nobility as his first wife and married her best Luaran friend for his second. His choices might not have been worthy of note in another man, but Mekwen was a descendant of the Luaran ruling house, the Ritavans. Did this mean the Luaran attitude was softening toward the enslaved Raka, or did it simply mean that Mekwen Balitang was far enough from the throne that no one cared whom he married? Sadly, Ali wouldn't get the chance to find out. Her parents would be fretting. She was going home, even if she had to manage all the arrangements herself. Her escape would have been easier if she could just visit one of Da's Rajmuat spies, but Ali didn't dare. Spies were not to be trusted. Her identity was a vital secret in this new, hostile world. Tortal's enemies would pay any sum for her in order to use Ali against her family. They might even suspect that Ali knew something of her father's work. If that happened, they would squeeze her like a lemon. With those stakes, an agent might give in to the temptation to sell her for a profit. Even a faithful agent's communications to George might be intercepted. Ali had to get out of this one on her own. There was a chance that her family might locate her first. Mother couldn't find her if Ali's dream had been true, and the god had made her believe it was. It had been too vivid, too clear, and too convincing for her to deny it. So Mother couldn't scry her. Her father or Uncle Numair might track her down. Normally she would have expected Aunt Dane to have animals out to search, but Aunt Dane was in the process of having a child. Even the wild mage couldn't attend to things while carrying a baby that changed shape constantly. Still, Ali wasn't going to wait for rescue. She would free herself. If that didn't convince her father she would be a good spy, nothing would. Sudden hammering on the house door made her jump. She hid her tools and went to see who was outside. A big white man and two men-at-arms, all soaked to the skin from the warm, pouring rain, strode into the hall. Ali greeted the first man with the deep bow of a slave to someone who was clearly a Luaran noble, her palms together before her chest. His men had brown and reddish-brown skins, marking them as warriors from either the lesser Raka nobility or the bulk of the regular population of the Isles.
"I know it's late and doubtless they've retired for the night," the Luaran nobleman said gravely, "but I'm afraid you must rouse the Duke and Duchess. Tell them Prince Bronau Jimajen has come with news of great import for them. Royal news.
Ali took the prince's sopping cloak and went to rouse Ulasim. The likes of her didn't visit Duke Mequen and Duchess Winamine in their personal quarters. When she gave Ulasim Bronau's message, the big Raka went pale.
See the prince to the Azure sitting room, he ordered as he struggled into his tunic. Show his men to the kitchen to be looked after.
Ask Chenaol for refreshments for his highness. Hurry! Ali spread Bronau's cloak before the kitchen hearth to dry as she passed on her orders to Chenaol. The cook sniffed.
Remember, you have the right to refuse if he invites you to his bed, girl, she advised as she set out a tray and a bottle of wine. His grace will back you. He lets no one force his slaves.
Not that many turn the prince down, though. When he visits the summer residences, he goes through maids like grease. A different one in his bed every night.
Ali nodded and ran to show Bronau to the sitting room. He took a chair with a sigh as Ali hurriedly lit candles, then the braziers that gave these city homes their warmth. As she worked, she reviewed what she knew of this man from the reports. Bronau was not of King Oron's immediate family, but he was the brother-in-law of Princess Imogene, the king's sole daughter. His older brother, Rubinion, had married the princess. Everyone who knew him said that Bronau was a good man in a fight, a commander who had the respect of his men and the affection of the king and his family. Ali glanced at him as she got the braziers going. He looked taller than he actually was, being only 3 inches taller than Ali. He had a warrior's build, with broad shoulders and heavily muscled thighs, fierce gray eyes, and winged brows over a nose that had been broken once. He wore his reddish-brown hair in waves to his shoulders, but kept his beard closely trimmed. His big hands carried an assortment of weapon scars. The main flaw in his comeliness lay in the mouth framed by his beard. His lips were thin, almost to the point of invisibility. Like most Luaran nobles, he wore the fashions of the eastern lands, remade for a jungle city. Elegant blue silk hose and a blue linen tunic over a semi-sheer shirt of white lawn. The tunic was embroidered in the Raka style along the collar and hems in a silver design of coiling dragons. He was dressed for an elegant spring party. His blue leather shoes were not meant for walking or riding in the rain, and he wore jeweled rings on every finger, a gold earring with a diamond bauble in one ear, and several gold chains on his chest. He caught Ali's eye and smiled, his face lighting with humor and tremendous charm. I know. I'm scarcely attired for the weather.
Ali gave him a sidelong glance, that of a woman who likes what she sees. He probably saw that look all the time and surely expected it. He smirked at her.
It's not for me to say, my lord prince, Ali murmured.
The relationship between Tortal and the Isles had always been unsteady. She would get a measure of this man now so that she could add to her father's notes about him when she returned. Their people seldom got the chance to talk to one of the most powerful men in the Copper Isles. Bronau's eyebrows came together with an almost audible snap.
Come here, girl, he said, beckoning.
Ali obeyed. There was little danger that he might try anything improper. Under slave etiquette, another man's slaves were to be left alone unless the master or the slave involved indicated otherwise. The prince gripped Ali's chin with his hand and inspected her face.
Not a drop of Raka blood in you, is there? He asked, curious.
No, my lord prince, murmured Ali, keeping her eyes down. Bronau released her.
I don't like the precedent keeping Luaran slaves. It gives the Raka ideas. See here, if these Raka dogs bother you, don't hesitate to tell Duke Mequen, he told Ali sternly. He looks out for the slave women, and you can't trust the Raka to behave themselves unless they know there's a whip close to hand.
My lord prince is too kind, Ali said, bowing once again. Bronau obviously didn't know that Chenaol, who could juggle razor-sharp cleavers with ease, had discouraged most problems of that sort. If you will excuse me, I will bring some refreshment to you, she murmured. Bronau nodded and settled into his chair, watching the embers in the nearest brazier. Ali fetched the pitcher of wine and the tray of fruit, cakes, and cheese the cook had put together to the sitting room. As she set the tray where Bronau could reach it, then poured him a glass of wine, she made sure that nothing in her manner told him that she was interested in giving him more than food and drink. It wouldn't take more than the right look and the right smile with this man.
She would be in his lap with his hand under her tunic before she could sneeze. Chen Aol was right. Bronau had a flirt's air. When Ali got home, she'd suggest to Da that they try one of their female agents with him. Bronau might tell far more than was prudent to a pretty listening ear. Once he was served, she left him. She fetched a mop and set to work cleaning up the water the guests had tracked onto the marble floor of the hall. She was nearly finished when Ulasim raced down the steps from the family quarters. He slowed when he approached the azure sitting room, straightened his tunic, then went in to the prince. Both men emerged a moment later to climb upstairs. Ali watched them go. She'd give much to know what Bronau told the Bali tongues. He'd said, royal business. Was that code for problems with the king? It could be. Oran was insane. Most of Ritavan House was these days. Ali's own mother had been forced to kill a Ritavan princess years before, when that lady started to kill people with an axe. The present Isles King was her uncle, a fearful and unstable man who turned on favored courtiers overnight. Eavesdropping was not an option. If she were observed anywhere but at her post by the door, she would be questioned. Instead, she finished mopping the floor. Later she would see what she could learn to take home to her da. The next day, the Duke and Duchess summoned the household to the hall where they held parties. It was the first time that Ali had seen any of the Balitong family but her master and mistress. Chen Aol named them for Ali. The proud brown-skinned girls, imperious 16-year-old Sarayu, and small, intense 12-year-old Dovasiri were the daughters of the Duke's first marriage to a Rakha noblewoman. His two full Luaran children, a 4-year-old girl, Petran, and 3-year-old Elzrin, who was still awkward on his short, rounded legs, were by Duchess Winamine. Other relatives who lived in the house were present, cousins who served Winamine as ladies-in-waiting, a great-aunt, and the Duke's uncle. Duchess Winamine sat on the dais, her elegant hands neatly clasped in her bronze velvet lap. Her brown eyes were only slightly accented with kohl, her brown hair dressed in curls that were tied up, then threaded through a velvet net on her head. Her sharp, straight nose and neatly curved mouth gave evidence of a strong will. She wore pearl drops in her ears, a gold chain around her neck, and only 3 rings, which was restraint in jewelry for an islander. Many wore rings on every finger and several earrings, men and women alike. Duke Mequen rose to his feet as the last to enter closed the doors behind them. He was about 5 feet 10 inches tall, with the solid build of a man who rode a great deal but spent little time practicing weapons skills. His dark eyes were set under perfectly curved brows and framed by laugh lines. His nose was broad and straight, his mouth wide, his chin square. He wore his dark hair clipped short to draw attention away from the fact that it was retreating from his forehead. He was somberly dressed, Luaran fashion, in a black linen tunic over a silvery shirt and gray hose, with a ruby-hilted dagger at his waist, a signet ring on the index finger of his left hand, and a gold hoop ring in one ear. Ali liked the look of him. She already knew from his servants that he was a fair man, if unconventional in the way he ran his home and chose his wives. Now she could also see that he was well-mannered and thoughtful, always nice traits to find in a noble. Slowly his people quieted. Mequen looked them over, hands clasped behind his back. "I'm sure you've heard rumors," he said, his deep voice clear throughout the room. "His Majesty is no longer confident about my loyalty. He has invited me to prove it with expensive presents. While he evaluates these presents, my family and I are invited to visit our estates on Lombin Island, where we must stay until he feels better about us." Shock raced through the people like a physical thing. Some of their families, free and slave, had worked for the Balitongs for generations. Because the Duke was uninterested in court intrigues, they had believed the king would never turn on him. "This breaks our hearts," Mequen said, his sorrow plain on his face and in his voice. "We are forced to sell lands and slaves to give the king the reassurances he requires, and those we can take with us are dreadfully few. Our Lombin holdings, the inheritance of Duchess Sarugani, the mother of his older daughters, are small." He glanced at his steward. "Our chief sources of income are not gold and gems, but sheep, goats, and rabbits. We cannot live there as we are accustomed to do. We cannot feed you all." By now, some of the women were crying. Husbands wrapped their arms around their wives. Children clung to their parents. The Duchess rose. "We will do our best to see you are cared for," she said, her calm voice flowing over them. "Our friends have asked to hire or purchase many of you. We will separate no families. We will sell you to no one known to treat his people badly. As soon as provision has been made, you will be told. It will be soon. We must be on our way in just a week." The Duke took up the explanation. "Should no one we trust offer for your service, we have sent for a matcher, one with connections and the magical gift to see what your aptitudes may be. He will examine you and obtain new places for you. That begins today." Mequin let out a deep sigh. "Some of you will come with us. Many of you already know who you are. For the rest, tell the steward if you desire to stay with us. But remember, we go to a rougher way of life, far from any town. We will have few amenities, less food. The highlands are colder than our jungles, the land inhospitable. Think it over." He paused, then nodded. "May the gods bless you. May they grant us all voyages to safe harbors." Chenaol shook her head, her mouth in a tight line. "It's back to the slave brokers for you, Ali girl, unless the matcher sees you have special skills."
"And you?" Ali asked, not worried in the least. She needed just two more nights to complete her picks. Once she was rid of her metal collar, she could bid farewell to the Balitangs and the Isles alike.
"I stay with Lady Sarai and Lady Dove," Chinaul replied. "Forever."
She left the room with the other departing servants, a short round Rakha woman dressed Luaran fashion in an orange gown. A curious way to put it, Ali thought as she mingled with the servants. Not with the Duke or with the family, only with the two daughters of the first Duchess, the Rakha Duchess. The longer Ali stayed here, the more she saw how frayed the relations between the full-blooded Luaran and the full-blooded Rakha were. A push from the right people might throw the entire country into civil war. That was news worth taking home. Too often in the past, the Copper Isles had meddled in Tortallan affairs. Perhaps its rulers needed something to keep them busy. The next morning, the slave matcher summoned all those who had not found other homes as yet. Most were the less skilled workers, hostlers, low-ranking footmen and maids, slaves whom the carpenter and the smith would not need in the north, and Ali. After the family's friends and well-wishers had made their selections, over 40 slaves remained. "How does this work?" Ali whispered to the boy who carried messages for the house as they lined up before the matcher. "I never heard of it before." The boy wasn't surprised. Everyone knew Ali was fresh caught out of Tortall. They never thought to wonder how she spoke Kiprish, the language of the islands, so well.
"He looks at you," he whispered. "He's got the magical gift and all. He's looked at the owners that hire through him, too, so he can match folks that go good together. Not that we'll have much luck, us not having skills. Less he sees a talent. Sometimes they can. The gifted matchers, anyways."
Ulasim led them into the grand hall. People had come and gone over the last day to remove paintings, tapestries, and candelabra for sale. All that remained were the tables and chairs. They would be carried off in the morning. Ulasim lined the slaves against the wall, his brown eyes alert for any sign of misbehavior. The matcher stood next to chairs occupied by Duke Mequin and Duchess Winamine, waiting. He was a plump black man in typical Rakha garb, a wraparound jacket and sarong, both made of serviceable tan linen. He shaved his head but grew a tuft of beard, which he stroked as he talked to the Balitangs. Now Mequin nodded to him. The slave matcher started at the far end of the line. Ali watched from under her lashes. After he had bathed each slave in the pale orange fire of his magical gift, the matcher conferred with Mequin and Winamine. Slowly he worked his way through the slaves until he was closer to Ali. She measured his gift. He was powerful enough to notice her magical sight. Doubtless he would try to do something with her because of it. She had the sight from her father, but its force was her mother's legacy. Magic ran strong in Alana's family. George used his sight to tell when he was being lied to or when someone held out on him. Sometimes he could also recognize one who would be his friend or his enemy. It was different for Ali. Her sight enabled her to see immediately whether the person she looked at had magic or godhood, whether that person was ill, pregnant, or lying. It also revealed the presence of poison in water or food. All she had to do was concentrate on how she wished to see something. Her power made it possible for her to clearly discern the tiniest of details, things invisible to the normal eye, or to see far into the distance. A new master might value it for as long as she stayed with him or her. Ali was unimpressed by her skill. She would have preferred to have the all-purpose gift wielded by her mother and her brother Tom. The matcher had come to Ali's neighbor. She closed her eyes against the glare of his gift as the man weighed the young slave. Finished, he addressed Mequen and Winamin. "I'll keep him with the others, see if he can be trained. I'll send your percentage of his final sale when it's made."
"Very well," Winamin said. "We've heard good things about your training school."
"It's to my advantage to treat them well," the matcher replied. "It always pays off."
The messenger left. Finally, the matcher came to Ali.
"Look up into my eyes, girl," he said, his melodic voice kind. "This won't hurt."
Ali met his gaze. The slightest hint of orange fire grew around his hands. Then the matcher hiccuped.
"What?" he began to say.
Something changed. Inside his round frame, Ali saw another body, compact, lean, wiry. Under his face lay another. Square, the strong chin covered in a short beard, a brief nose broad at the tip, sparkling dark eyes and short hair. This was not an internal aspect of the matcher. This was something else.
"Well, well," Ali thought, amazed. "I have a god."
Gold light spread from the matcher's body, flaring out around him like a sun. The Balitong stepped back, shielding their eyes against the light with their hands. Vast, bell-like tones that sounded vaguely like speech rang out, the effect so powerful that Mequen and Winamin dropped to their knees. Ali felt no urge to kneel. Nor did that light hurt her eyes as it did those of her owners. She gazed at the being who had come to occupy the matcher's body and leaned back against the wall, crossing her arms over her chest.
"Hello there." A crisp, light voice, not the matcher's, came from the man's lips. "I apologize that we weren't able to meet earlier. I hope your journey here wasn't too harrowing."
"It was delightful," Ali said with her best nice girl smile. "All lovely and serene, like sleeping on lilies, only without the bees in my nose. You spoke to me in my dream."
"I did," the god said, averting his eyes in a falsely modest way. "You'll get more. I don't want you to get homesick."
"But that's so thoughtful," Ali said innocently. "I'd thank you, but I just don't have the words.
Until I find some, you might tell me just who you're supposed to be. Won't that be lovely?"
"Dear, you're being deliberately obtuse," the god inside the matcher teased. "You know a god when you see one. You may call me Kiprioff." Ali thought swiftly. She didn't recognize the god's name, which didn't necessarily mean anything. God's names and importance varied from country to country.
"Why would I want to call you anything, sir?" she asked, still in her character of a sweet young girl.
"Because I might be of use to you. In fact, I already have been."
Kiprioff reached into the matcher's jacket and pulled out a tiny ball of light.
"You sent a prayer to my sister, the great goddess, in the matter of who would purchase you. I intercepted it. Since I took care of that little matter myself, you may have the prayer back."
Ali frowned at him, forgetting her impersonation. She looked at the strong, wiry hand inside the matcher's well-padded one.
"You did what?"
Kiprioff smiled. It looked extremely odd under the matcher's unmoving features.
"I made certain that you would go to the Balitongs and no one else. I fixed your seeming so that no one else would bid on you."
Ali scowled at him.
"Do you mean I got my nose broken, my eyebrow scarred, and the rest of me all battered for nothing?"
"The eyebrow scar is quite dashing," Kiprioff told her earnestly. "I'll fix your nose if you like."
Ali covered her nose with a protective hand.
"No, I got this nose the hard way, and I'm keeping it."
"Well, keep this too," the god said, thrusting the light ball at her.
Use it to appeal to the goddess another time. Ali reached out and took the ball. It oozed into her skin like water into sand and vanished. She rubbed the spot, looking the god over. "What have you done to them?" she asked curiously, nodding to the kneeling duke and duchess. "They're talking to a great god," Kiprioth assured her. "Not me, they wouldn't listen to me, but to my brother. They can't see or hear us, if that's what you're worried about. He's telling them that they are beloved of destiny and are meant for great things in this world. They are to be wise and accept their banishment, for their time of greatness will come." Ali raised an eyebrow at him as she mentally listed the other great gods that this one might be. "Won't Mithros mind that you borrowed his seeming?" she wanted to know. "All the legends I've ever heard say he objects to it. Strenuously." "What he doesn't know won't hurt him," Kiprioth said blithely. "I happen to know he's dealing with the start of a war on the other side of the world just now. Both sides are invoking him, of course, silly mortals. Don't you want to know what his seeming is telling them about you?" "Not interested," Ali replied, smiling at the god with easy good humor. "I have plans."
"Very like your father, manner and all," Kiprioth informed her with a pleased smile. "I can't believe he hasn't the wit to put you to some proper work."
"You talk like you know him," Ali remarked. This was starting to get interesting.
"He and I have done quite a bit of business together."
"He never mentioned you," Ali said. "At our house, we usually share what gods are monkeying about with us today."
"Of course he never mentioned me," Kiprioth answered. "What sane man wants the people around him to know he's favored of a trickster? They might suspect that my favor causes certain interesting events in their lives, don't you think? Your father knows there's no point in mentioning something he can't change."
"I'll tell him you said so," replied Ali, her mind in a whirl. Her father would definitely have to explain this to her. She couldn't wait.
"Actually, you won't," said Kiprioth. His speech was clear, crisp, and fast, a promise of amusement in every inflection. It was the kind of voice that talked people into doing mad stunts. It made Ali very wary of him.
"At least not right away," he amended.
"I have a small wager for you first. Play this out for me, and I'll deposit you at the cove at Pirate Swoop. I'm the local sea god, among other things."
Ali raised an eyebrow.
"Why should I dance to some trickster's tune?"
Kiprioth chuckled, a rich, warm sound.
"Oh, my dear, I'm not some trickster," he informed her. "I'm THE trickster. Kiprioth is the name I have here in the Copper Isles, in addition to rule over our seas. Don't you even want to hear my wager?"
He leaned close to Ali and whispered,
"It's made to order for a girl with your skills."
Ali shrugged, hiding her sudden interest behind a mask of boredom. "I suppose I won't be rid of you until you tell me, so talk away."
"It's simple," he assured her. "Keep the children of this family alive through the end of summer. Do that, and I'll send you home as the gods travel. You'll be here one moment and there the next."
"And if I can't, if I lose?" Ali wanted to know.
"You'll serve me for an entire year," Kiprioth replied. "If you're still alive. I can't make any promises. If things go really badly, you might be killed by accident."
Ali twiddled her thumbs, pretending to ignore him. She wanted him to raise the stakes. Kiprioth sighed.
"I'll convince your father to let you be a field agent. I'm a god. I can do that."
"You can't force him," Ali said. She spoke from long experience with her father.
"No, but he'll pay attention if I tell him how good you are on your own," he explained. "I have a feeling you have a real knack for this, and I'll grant him a boon as well."
"I'm a slave," Ali reminded him. "These people won't listen to me."
"They will now," Kiprioth beamed at Ali. "That's why I needed my brother's seeming. He's telling the Duke and Duchess that he's chosen you, someone their enemies will overlook, as his messenger. That they will come to no harm if they listen to your advice. Sooner or later, of course, you'll have to prove to them you're worth listening to, but I'm sure you'll have plenty of chances for that. Have we a wager?"
Ali considered it, rubbing her hand over her short-cropped hair. From her true dream, she knew Mother had already gone north for the summer's fighting, and making things right with her had been the only reason Ali was prepared to rush home.
On one hand, the wager meant she would have to follow the Balitongs into exile. On the other hand, what better way to prove to Da that she could manage the work? Even if he wouldn't let her spy, he might attach her to the king or queen as a sort of bodyguard to keep an eye on things. He'd know her ability if Ali showed him that she was able to keep a family in one piece when they were out of favor with a notoriously unstable king. She might never get another chance like this. Her father would be hard put to argue with the god's assessment, especially if that god was the trickster. Ali grinned. Even Da couldn't refuse her if she did it. He was very good about admitting when he was wrong. "We have a wager, then, under those terms," she told Kiprioth. "But I'll need help." The god grabbed her stubbly head in both hands and kissed her forehead. Ali yelped. The kiss sent something like a shock through her. "You'll get it," Kiprioth said, "on Lomban." With that, he was gone. If you've a story, make sure it's a whole one, with details close to hand. It's the difference between a successful lie and getting caught. From a workbook for a young spy, written and illustrated by Ali's father and given to her on her 6th birthday. Chapter 3. The Raqqa. The Long Strait and the Azure Sea. People out of favor with King Oran did not waste time in farewells. The king had slaughtered entire households down to the last dog once he decided he could not live with his fears. 2 days after Ali entered into her wager with Kiprioth, the Balitongs loaded their belongings onto several cargo ships and prepared to set sail. Only Prince Bronow came to see them off that humid morning. He kissed the Duchess on both cheeks, embraced the Duke, and kissed Lady Sarayu's hand. Ali barely glimpsed this. Her new charges, Petran and Elzrin, did not care for ships, or the early hour, or Ali herself. Their governess and nursemaids had gone to other households along with 74 other servants and slaves. Winamine assigned their care to Ali as the reason they had kept her with them. Neither the Duke nor the Duchess had summoned her to discuss the visitation from the god they believed to be Mithros. Instead, they hid their thoughts behind polite, distant faces and told Ulasim that Ali would mind the little ones. Ali hung on to Petran and Elzrin as they jerked and shrieked in her grip. At last she gave up trying to hear. She read the adult's lips as she'd been taught by her father. "I'll try to get word of events to you as often as possible," Bronow assured the older Balitongs. "The king's none too healthy. Things could change suddenly if he passes on. If Hazarin takes the throne, for instance." "Don't speak of such things," Mequin told Bronow. "It could be taken for treason." Winamine rested a hand on the prince's arm. "Try to be careful, Bronow." The prince grinned, then walked down the gangplank as the crew prepared to cast off. The Balitongs waved farewell. Bronow stood on the edge of the dock, watching as the ship weighed anchor.
"Come on, you Raqqa dogs, put your backs into it," yelled the Luaran captain to his sailors. "Less you want a touch of the whip to smarten you."
It was how many Luaran and Rajmuat who were not part of the Balitong circle addressed their Raqqa slaves and servants. Ali thought it was a foolish way to talk to someone who might be inspired to throw one over the rail into a shark-infested sea, but she would be the first to admit she did not have a conqueror's heart. She couldn't see who would profit by keeping the original owners of a country ground into the dirt. Elzrin broke out of Ali's hold and ran toward the rail. Still clinging to Petran, Ali seized the boy by his shirt with her free hand and dragged him back.
"I want Jaffa,"
wailed Elzrin, tears running down his plump cheeks. Jafana had been his nursemaid.
"I hate you."
Ali sighed and wrapped an arm around him. "I know, and I'm sorry," she replied. "In your shoes, I'd hate me too, but we're stuck with one another." She looked at Petran. Tears rolled down the little girl's cheeks. "Sometimes being a noble isn't much fun, is it?" she asked. Petran shook her head. Ali glanced at Mequin and Winamine. They waited at the rail, none of their feelings on display as the ship drew out into the harbor. As Elzrin calmed, Ali studied the city, not having seen it when she first arrived. Rajmuat was splendid, full of peaked gates and 3-level temples, each with a spike tower thrust into the sky.
White or rose-pink walls contrasted with the dark green of the trees that lined its streets. Homes also sported peaked roofs and intricately carved eaves, those on wealthy houses traced in gold or silver. Something else reflected the sun, too, pricking Ali's eyes with swords of light. She looked up. High above the city, storm wings circled like vultures over a carcass. Ali shivered. These part-human, part-metal immortals feasted on the rage, fear, and death spawned by human combat. Their wings, each metal feather shaped precisely like a bird's, were the source of the bright flashes of sun on steel.
"They always know," Winamin spoke quietly. "The storm wings, they always know when unrest is starting. How can they tell?"
Mequon put an arm around her shoulders.
"We don't know if they do, my dear," he replied. "Maybe they just know that it's a sure bet in Rajmuat. There will be fighting in the streets, if he doesn't appoint an heir soon, or if something happens to whomever he appoints. We're going to be well out of it."
"We hope we're well out of it now," replied the Duchess. Ali knew she had a point. Sometimes King Oren did recover from his fears. Sometimes he didn't. Sometimes he got worse. If Kiprioth was dragging Ali into the Isle's affairs, they might well be growing. At least the Balitungs wouldn't miss life at court. They occupied themselves with charity work, fashions, books, and music, not politics, court, or trade. They kept their own accounts and oversaw the work of the household. Ali suspected that they would settle quietly into rural life, given half a chance. If she was to win her wager, she had to ensure that they would get that chance, at least until the summer was over. She wondered why a great god would take such a brief interest in the family. In her experience, once a god took an interest in a mortal, that mortal was stuck with that god for life. Still, that wasn't Ali's problem right now. Safeguarding this family without calling notice to herself was her problem. If anyone were to find out that the daughter of the Tortallan King's champion and his assistant spymaster was summering in the Copper Isles, she wouldn't live long enough to collect on that wager. The thought made her grin as she turned her face into the fresh sea breeze. At long last, she had a real challenge, and she meant to enjoy every moment of it. The captain never made good on his threats to smarten his Raqqa seamen with his whip. The ship glided up the long strait. The warm, damp winds drove them gently north along the long, slender neck of water that separated Kipriang, the capital island, from Jempang Isle in the west. Dolphins, always a sign of good luck, sped alongside the vessel, watching its occupants with mischievous eyes and what looked like mocking smiles. The long strait was another world compared to Rajmuat's crowded streets and busy docks. Limestone cliffs rose high on either side, threaded with greenery and falling streams, capped with emerald jungles that steamed as the day warmed up. Brightly colored birds soared to and fro, indifferent to the ships that plowed the blue waters. From the Jempang jungles came the long, drawn-out hoots of the howler monkeys.
"Tell me a story,"
demanded Elsrin after his afternoon nap.
"Yes, a story,"
Petran insisted, sitting up against the rail with her legs crossed.
"A new story. Jaffa only ever tells the same ones."
"Did not," retorted her brother. Petran stuck her tongue out at him.
Ali listened to the howler monkeys and smiled. She sat cross-legged in front of the two children, keeping one hand in Elsrin's belt. She had spent the morning dragging him from under the crew's feet. "Once the most beautiful queen in all the world had a menagerie," she began, thinking wickedly how Aunt Thayet would screech if she could hear this story again. "In it were those self-same monkeys you hear all around us, the howlers. Now, the queen was often out and about, and the only things she liked better than coming home were her reunions with her beloved king and an unbroken night's sleep." Softly she told them about menagerie keepers who sold places in the palace gardens near the queen's balcony the nights after her return, then roused the howler monkeys to break the silence with their loud, penetrating calls. Woken from her sleep, the hot-tempered queen would race onto her balcony, bow and arrows in hand, in an attempt to shoot the beasts no matter how dark the night. Those who watched from below rejoiced in the fact that their queen slept without a nightgown. "Of course, the king's spymaster put a stop to it once he knew," Ali concluded seriously. "He made the keepers use the money they'd made to build another enclosure for the howlers where they wouldn't disturb the queen."
But there are still men who will swear by every god you know that they truly have the most beautiful queen in all the world.
Patran and Elsrin stared back at Ali soberly. Finally, Elsrin said,
That one was new. Tell another.
Yes, another, pleaded his sister.
That was a good one.
You're from Tortal, aren't you?
Ali turned to look for the source of the new voice. The older girls, Sarayu and Dovisiri, stood nearby, listening as Sarai fanned herself. There was no way for Ali to read what they thought in their level eyes or polite faces. It occurred to her that, being half Raka, these girls must have learned to hide their feelings well. They would have heard the people of Rajmuat and the rest of the Isles speak with careless cruelty of their mother's people. They may even have heard some of that cruelty from nobles of their own class. Dovisiri continued,
Your Kiprish is very good. You barely have an accent.
Thank you, your ladyship, Ali replied meekly.
She knew her accent was not Tortalan. Her teachers had come from Imahane Isle and had pronounced her Kiprish as perfect.
The Balitang spoke with a Rajmuat accent.
My sister asked you a question, Sarayu said imperiously. Are you from Tortal?
Ali bowed her head, every inch of her the perfect servant.
Yes, your ladyship.
Dovisiri plopped herself down beside Elsrin and pulled him onto her lap. Ali disentangled her fingers from his belt.
Then you know stories of the king's champion there, the one they call the lioness, she said eagerly.
For the first time since Ali had seen her, the younger girl's eyes were alive with interest.
Tell us some.
Is she really 10 feet tall? Asked Patran.
Sarayu settled neatly beside Ali, disposing her cotton skirts perfectly. Waving her fan, she asked,
Is the lioness as good with a sword as they say?
The Duchess made me stop my sword lessons.
Her voice turned frosty as she spoke of her stepmother.
She said they were unladylike.
Ali scratched her head to cover her confusion.
Can I talk of mother as if I'd never seen her in my life? She wondered.
No. As if I'd seen her once or twice at a distance. They'll expect that. When Chenaul and Ulasim had first brought her to Balitang House, the steward had questioned her about her origins. Ali had claimed then that she'd been a merchant's daughter and a maid at Fief Tamaran, south of Pirate Swoop. The household there had been close to the Grand Progress several years ago. Everyone would have turned out to see the monarchs, the prince and princess, and the king's champion ride by. Now she folded her hands in her lap.
The lioness is really that good with a sword, your ladyship, she replied to Sarai, this time acting the role of a polite servant.
King's champion isn't a title for decoration. Every time a noble demands a challenge to settle a matter of law, the champion must fight and win for the crown.
What happens when she loses? Asked Patran.
Ali looked at the child, startled.
She doesn't.
But everybody loses sometime, Sarai told Ali.
Not the lioness, Ali said, her mind scrambling. Mother lose? How could she?
Not since she's been champion that I know of.
Remember, you only know the stories, she ordered herself.
She must have lost sometimes when she was training, maybe even when she first got her shield, Dovisiri pointed out. And Tortal's at war. She could be killed in that.
Ali's pulse raced. She fought to sound natural, to keep from showing her distress at the idea.
Oh, well, training and that, everyone loses, she said with a shrug when she was sure of her control. But the war's a year old already, and the lioness is hale enough. She visited her home just before I was taken.
If Alana was killed in the fighting this year, she would die without Ali having said goodbye.
Tell us, begged Sarayu, leaning forward, her dark eyes eager. Tell us how she came to be the champion. Tell us how she found the Dominion Jewel. Tell us everything.
Ali only had time to tell them the story of how the lioness had brought the Dominion Jewel home to her king. Then Duchess Winamin declared it was time for the children to study. Even Elsrin had lessons in counting to do. Ali remained topside, relieved of her duties for the time being. She stood at the rail, enjoying the calls of colorful birds, the clear blue water under the ship's prow, and the sheer loveliness of the spring day. She registered movement along the clifftops on either side of the strait. Ali sharpened her sight for a good look, her fingers clenched on the rail as she realized that she saw hundreds of copper-skinned Raka, men and women alike, dressed in the traditional wrapped jacket or round-collared tunic and the tied shirt-like wrap called a sarong. Some wore garments that were richly decorated and jeweled, with more jewelry on their fingers and at their throats. Others wore plain colors with embroidery and strings of beads for ornament. The women drew their straight black hair away from their faces in a double-domed style, much like that of Yamani women, while the men wore headbands, turbans, or hats. The Raka groups were of all ages, from the smallest infants to the oldest adults. They stood in silence, as far as Ali could tell, watching as the Balitang vessel passed by. She turned to look back down the strait to check whether the natives watched all shipping out here. Two vessels earlier had overtaken the three that carried the Duke's household. No other ships followed in their wake, and nowhere did she see people on the cliffs behind them. The Raka left as soon as the Duke's ship drew out of easy view. She tugged at a sailor's arm as he coiled rope on the deck. "Do they always do that?" she asked, pointing at their audience. "Come and see boats go by? They don't look like they mean to attack." The half-Raka man looked at her, then at the cliffs.
"No," he said quietly, "they do not do that. They prefer to remain unseen when the Luaran pass."
He touched Ali's slave collar.
"Do not draw attention to it," he said, nodding toward the Duke and Duchess,
who sat at a small table in the bow playing chess.
"The Luaran get uneasy when the Raka do things they don't understand."
"I want to understand." Ali thought it, but she did not say it. She doubted that the sailor would confide in her. One thing seemed obvious. Something about these ships drew the interest of many people on the two islands. The Raka faces, when she used her magical sight to better examine them, were expectant and eager. The sailor had told her the watchers were not typical. Something about the Duke's party drew their attention. His servants? Ali wondered, drumming her fingers on her thigh as she turned the matter over in her mind. Or his oldest daughters? Mequen was a Ritavan, a lesser one, but still of the line of the Luaran conquerors. Below decks she heard Elsrin yell,
"I want up!"
Ali's rest time was over. Before she fetched the child, Ali took one more look at the cliffs. The Raka they had passed were leaving, returning to their jungle towns and their Luaran masters' estates. That night after supper, the Duke and Duchess read to their younger children from a book of Raka myths. Ali returned to the ship's rail to watch the cliffs around their anchorage, a small cove on Kipriang's lush western shore. The night, warm and damp, folded around her like a blanket. With her magical vision, she didn't need light to see the Raka, standing or seated on rocks that overlooked the cove. It seemed they required no light either. Lamps burned only aboard the trio of ships that rocked on the gentle waters. The moon had just begun to show its rim over the mountains that formed Kipriang Isle's spine.
"There are people, too."
12-year-old Dovisseri rested her hands on the rail as she came to stand beside Ali. She spoke in common, not Kiprish.
"Our mother, Sarai's and mine, was a Raka, Sarugani of Temaidia. Her family was of the older nobility, from before the Luaran came, but they don't have a title higher than Baron now."
"They're lucky to have that much. None of our Raka family talks about who they were, what they did before the invasion," Sarayu remarked quietly.
She came to lean on the rail on Ali's other side.
"They must have seen their friends being slaughtered or sold. They would have beggared themselves with the conquest taxes rather than suffer the same fate."
"You're half Luaran yourself," replied Ali, her voice idle, her attention apparently on the shoreline. "Begging your ladyship's pardon.
That would be the half that Cousin Oren seems determined to murder or disgrace," Sarai pointed out. "Even a madman should have more care for his own blood kin, particularly given the nest of vipers at court."
Ali smoothed a hand over the rail. "Forgive me for saying it, but your ladyship comes close to treasonous talk," she murmured. "I'd as soon be with the part of the family that's exiled but alive."
"You won't betray us," Sarayu replied casually. "I don't know about Tortal, but here the entire household is executed along with a suspected traitor. Then they sell the one who reported their masters, if they're known, to Karthak."
"Ouch," said Ali, meaning it. "That's not the way to create support among the lower classes."
"The thinking is that a servant of traitors who turns the traitors in is doubly treasonous to her master as well as the king," Dovisseri explained. They like to nip that sort of thing in the bud. Sarai turned to face east, watching the moon rise, leaning back on the rail with her elbows and rump. The torchlight slid along her long, barely hooked nose and over a full, sensual lower lip, then flickered along the curved lines shaped by her plain pink Luaran-style gown. It lent sparkle to her brown eyes and caressed her perfectly arched brows and high cheekbones. "Is it so hard being half Rakha?" Ali wanted to know. "All Rajmuat, even a fresh-cut Luaran slave like me, knows the Lady Sarayu is considered one of the beauties of the city." Sarai's smile was crooked. "By men and the Rakha nobility and some of the Luaran houses, yes, I suppose." She looked at her sister. "It's not vanity, Dove. I can count as well as the next person." Dove shrugged. "I didn't utter a word." Sarai made a noise that in a less attractive girl would have been labeled a snort. "And yet, when it comes to marriage, it's amazing how many Luaran families discover marriages that were arranged when their sons were in the cradle. Marriages their young men had never heard of until then. Particularly the higher-ranking Luaran nobles. I can't help but notice how many young men give way when they learn their mothers don't care for the color of the future bride's skin, however beautiful she may be." Dove sighed. "And the Rakha nobles are wary around us because we've got Ritavan blood in our veins. They don't want to lose their sons the next time the king thinks his relatives are plotting against him." "Dove Asiri," whispered Sarai, shocked. The younger girl leaned around Ali to look at her sister. "I have ears, Sarai, and people hardly ever notice me. I know what I hear. The Rakha don't want to risk the Ritavan insanity for their grandchildren." Ali grimaced. She'd once overheard one of Tortal's young knights, a Bajir, tell Grandfather Miles, "Oh, I'm considered wonderful when it comes to letting and losing blood for the crown, but marriage? Even jumped-up merchants who weren't barons a generation ago won't let their daughters marry a Bajir, whatever their wealth and standing." "I suppose I'd best remember what the Bajir at home endure," she thought, "before I go looking down my nose at the Luaran. You really should have a clean house at home before you start picking at the way your neighbor does the dusting." "What does a slave know of treason and kings, anyway?" asked Dove. Her dark eyes were now intent on Ali's face. Ali shrugged. "I was a maid in a nobleman's castle when I was taken," she replied. "My ears are as good as anyone's." "I don't see how any Tortalan girl would want to be a maid, not with all the choices you have, compared to us," Sarai remarked. "If I lived there, I'd join the Queen's Riders and learn to ride and use a sword and bow like they do. Or maybe even become a knight like the Lady Knight Kaladri. The Rakha ladies of old knew how to fight. In the last great battle against the Luaran on the Plain of Sorrows, a third of the Kiprin warriors were female." "And the whole army got thrashed," Dove reminded her sister mercilessly. "The conquerors had more battle mages and more catapults and ballistas and liquid fire. It didn't matter how many women fought with the Rakha that day. They died just as easily as the men." "You are so prosaic, Dove." "Oh, look, the Rakha." Sarai pointed to the rocks about the cove. The moon was above the mountains now, a huge pearl in the indigo sky. By its light, the people on the cliffs were clearly visible. "They've been doing that all day." "Sarai," called Winamine. "Dove. It's time to sleep." The two girls rolled their eyes at one another. "No late nights for us," Sarai remarked dryly. They went below. Ali turned back to watch the sea by moonlight. The older Balitang girls struck her as being much like falcons, always hooded and tethered, not able to hunt as their hearts desired. It was such a waste, keeping fiery girls like this in the background, not letting them forge their own path in the world. She'd like to see what these two would accomplish. 2 mornings later, their ships emerged from the long strait into the Azure Sea, the body of water that lay between Imahin and Lomban Isles. Ali grinned as the captain jubilantly announced that the sea god Kiprioth was smiling on their voyage. Apparently, this was the quickest, smoothest passage of the strait the captain had ever made. Duke Mequen finally stopped the man's recital of how unpredictable the passage could be, a tale of cross-currents and wind gusts, with a reminder that he might annoy the god by too frequently mentioning his name. Ali wasn't sure how easily annoyed Kiprioth was, but she was distracted from her thoughts as the Azure Sea emerged from its veil of morning fog. Its bright blue waters were clear. Vividly colored fish darted through its depths, circling a population of sea turtles, dolphins, and the occasional eel. The sun burnished the tops of the waves to the color of gold. Eldrin leaned precariously over the rail.
"Gullboats!"
he cried. Ali seized his Luaran-style tunic, securing her adventurous charge. A multitude of boats was gliding toward them from Imahin, Ikang, and Kipriang Isles. They were as colorful as the fish, with brightly colored sails, prows, and sterns fashioned in long, pointed curves, and every inch of outer hull decorated and painted. Ra'ka sailors, both men and women, dressed in no more than vivid sashes and sarongs, steered the graceful craft as they stared at the Balitang ships.
"Have you ever seen anything like this?"
Mekwen asked the captain.
"Never," the man replied, sweating. "Never. And I grew up on the Azure Sea."
"They're unarmed," Winamin commented. She had a spyglass raised to her eye.
"I don't see a weapon anywhere."
As the Balitang ship sailed north, the fleet of colorful boats parted before them. Elzrin and Patran clamored for a place in the bow. With Ali to keep them from falling overboard, they waved gleefully at the Ra'ka and loudly admired the rainbow bevy of ships. With the dignity suited to their more advanced years, Sarai and Dove came forward to stand with Patran and Elzrin, watching as their mother's people approached. Ali sharpened her sight until she could see the Ra'ka's faces. The sailors stiffened when the older girls showed themselves. Some pointed to them. The Ra'ka flotilla swerved, its ships forming two polite lines. Then one by one, the ships glided past the Balitang family's ship, one on either side of their bow. The Ra'ka merely glanced at the three Luaran faces, Ali's, Patran's, Elzrin's, then fixed on Sarai's and Dove's light brown ones. "It's not us who brought the Ra'ka out," Ali thought. "It's Sarai and Dove." The two half-Ra'ka girls. The two girls whose mother came from an old noble house. A Ra'ka noble house.
"If you're wise, you will say nothing of this to anyone," Winamin said from behind them, her melodic voice soft. "Ever. Do you all understand? The king would not like to hear that we drew so much attention from the Ra'ka."
Sarai shrugged. "Nobody cares what the Ra'ka do," she replied, gazing at the people who sailed by.
"Especially not the king."
"You never know who is watching," persisted Winamin.
"Don't encourage them. Go below.
When Papa says..."
Dove didn't even look at her stepmother. Ali knew Winamin was right. It seemed that she could start to cover her part of Kiprioth's wager here and now.
"My ladies, my apologies, but this scares me," she whispered, the picture of an alarmed slave. "I've not been here long, but, well, back home there's stories of your king. This could get your house and those Ra'ka in trouble with him. We'd all pay for that in blood, most like."
Sarai glanced at Ali, confused. Ali looked at her and shrugged, suggesting that it was just her opinion. Dove sighed. She grabbed Sarai's hand and towed her older sister below.
"Well done," murmured the Duchess.
Ali looked up 3 inches into the Duchess's face.
"The wisdom of what you said was just a little slow in reaching their brains," she offered.
"We both know it was the suggested threat to the Ra'ka that convinced them," replied Winamin. She rubbed her temples.
"They liked me well enough when I married their father, but now they're old enough to be difficult, just because I tell them things they don't wish to hear."
Ali thought of her own mother and winced inwardly. "It's hard living in the shadow of a respected woman," she told the Duchess. Winamin looked at her sharply. "Very wise for a girl Sarai's age. Perhaps the one who appeared when the matcher looked you over chose well," she said, referring to the god's visit in terms that Patran and Elzrin wouldn't understand.
"He said you were clear-sighted and would see a way for us out of all this."
"I'm sure I won't need to do any such thing," Ali replied cheerfully. "You'll hardly know I'm here." Winamin shook her head with a rueful smile, then watched the Ra'ka craft that continued to sail by. After a moment, she returned to Mekwen. Tired of the spectacle, Patran and Elzrin followed her. Ali remained in the bow, leaning on the rail. It was embarrassing to think that rather than truly expressing her independence, she had been difficult with her mother just for the sake of being difficult, because she was 16 and stubborn. That night they anchored in the harbor at Amberrip, off the northeast point of Imahin Isle. The family slept ashore at a proper inn. Mequen's and Winamine's servants took care of the younger children. Ali remained with the rest of the household, the servants, slaves, and men-at-arms. They set up a communal supper on the beach near the dock where the ships were anchored. Chenaol took